Welcome back to CMDA Matters. And this week we have a very unique, a special program for you. This is the weekly podcast of the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. And I'm Dr. Mike Chupp, the Chief Executive Officer of CMDA. And today it's my privilege to have our Senior Vice President of Bioethics and Public Policy, Dr. Jeff Barrows. Welcome to the program, Jeff.
Thank you, Mike. It's good to be with you again.
It was only about 6 months ago that we were here in this studio recording not only on audio, but also doing a video because of our intent to talk about COVID-19, and here we are again.
I think over the summer we had hoped we were past COVID-19, but unfortunately it was not so.
No, we're here again, and it seems like matters. There are all kinds of issues that keep growing, and I think that's one of the reasons we decided to come back for our listeners to talk about some issues. I just wanted to give a shout out to you, Jeff. For our listeners, Dr. Barrows has been our person at National Ministry who's tried to remain engaged on a number of issues in the public square, but chief among them often has been the COVID-19 pandemic.
Yeah, to my ability, as I get time, and it's been enjoyable. It's been interesting to learn a lot about epidemiology and a little bit of virology along the way, so it's been my joy.
Well, many of you are listening, whether in your cars or your treadmills, as you listen each week to CMDA Matters. But this week, we're actually doing a video because Dr. Barrows has some slides to help with his presentation. I'm going to ask him a number of questions on very common questions, topics that our listeners, whether physicians, other primary care, healthcare professionals, spouses, anyone who's listening, it's not gonna be the first time probably that they've heard people talking about these issues, but we've been told over and over again that people often look to CMDA for a trustworthy source of information.
Yeah, and I want our focus to be on the facts, on the medical evidence that's out there. I think that's the best language that we can use and try and present what we know and hopefully talk about a little bit about what we don't yet know.
Well, just for those of you who are listening into the program on the podcast, there will be in our show notes today a link that you can go to online that will allow you to access the slides that Dr. Barrows has put together for our presentation today. If you're watching on video, you're going to be able to see the data, the information as we go along.
Yeah, and the slides will also contain the references at the end if you're curious about what studies we're looking at and exactly where I got the data.
Well, thank you, Jeff, for preparing. And let's just jump right in. So if you had to give just an executive summary of where we are in this pandemic in the middle of October, after some ups and downs over the last 18 to 24 months, where are we right now in the pandemic?
Well, I think the best way to illustrate that is with the first slide, which is really the data in terms of new daily cases or the daily average. And of course, we all know that the spike that we had previously was toward the end of 2020 and over the holidays. And it went down fairly quickly over the spring with the onset of the vaccines coming out and a lot of people getting vaccinated, to the point where we were at a pretty good low right around the end of June and first part of July. And that's when I was thinking, oh good, this is something that's now behind us. And then came along the Delta variant. And the Delta variant then shot up a spike of cases all around the country and really all around the world. And that tended to peak right around the end of August, early September. And fortunately, right now, we're again on a downslope. Our experience is very similar to what happened in India, where the Delta variant began in December of 2020. And so what's essentially happening is that the Delta variant is running out of people to infect, either because they've already been infected or, to some degree, they've been vaccinated. So the latest numbers we have here in mid-October are about 90,000 daily cases. And it's interesting, there is a group of about 13 different universities from within the United States and across the world that is attempting to create modeling scenarios of what to expect in the future. And they've created several different scenarios, and the most optimistic, I would say, is that if in fact we have success in getting the pediatric vaccine approved, and most importantly, there's not a new variant that arises that's highly transmissible, their projection is that by March of 2022, that the daily cases will be down to around 9,000 versus where they are now, about 90,000 per day.
Well, a common question I know that you've been asked, I get asked, whether inside CMDA or when I go home and talk to my family, I've seen so many different graphical representations and data. I think our listeners would like to hear from your perspective about efficacy of the vaccines? And, you know, feel free to talk about pre-Delta variant and now where we are in terms of Delta variant. I'm amazed at the views. I know we've talked about this a lot, at how some of our members have doubted any efficacy in preventing COVID-19. So I think this is an important question.
Yeah, when you talk about efficacy, Mike, you got to talk about exactly efficacy against what? Is it against infection? Is it against hospitalization, severe disease, or death? And I think the easiest way to look at it, probably I think the best way as well, is to talk in terms of severe disease and hospitalization. That's what we're trying to accomplish mm-hmm. with a vaccine. And that's really where a lot of the data is. And I do have a slide that just kind of graphically shows by a variety of studies, it's not every study by any stretch, but for multiple different studies, looking at the efficacy. The first slide is on the mRNA vaccines, which is obviously Pfizer and Moderna. And all of those efficacies in terms of prevention of severe disease and hospitalization is really somewhere between 78% and the highest is 98%. And that's remarkable for a vaccine. And it's all very good. And if you look a little bit further, the next slide that we're going to show is looking at the Janssen vaccine, which is from Johnson & Johnson. That's a different vaccine platform. It's called a viral vectored vaccine. And the efficacy in preventing hospitalization with that vaccine have been a little less than the mRNA, but still very good, running between about low 70s, high 60s, up to about 80% efficacy in preventing hospitalization. That is all before the Delta variant. And then we have to look at what happens with the Delta variant. And there isn't as much data yet on that. The Delta variant, again, hit us here beginning in July in the United States. And we've got about three studies that look at that. And when you, again, focus simply on efficacy against hospitalization, there really wasn't much change or drop in the mRNA vaccines. They still are about 75 up to 85% efficacious, depending on the study that you look at, which is very good news. We don't have quite as much data in terms of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. And that's very different. And there'll be people that will point to efficacy against preventing infections. With the mRNA, it's much less than that. But again, I think our overall goal that we want to focus on is preventing hospitalizations.
Another concern, and it's valid concern, is in terms of morbidity that comes, the consequences, side effects that come from the mRNA or other vaccines by various decades of life, and that the reality is the risk, some people believe, is too high for younger people. Talk to us about what's happened and the VAERS system that we talked about it during our last interview.
Yeah. The VAERS system has been a common question that comes up. And in order to answer it, it's obviously very important to understand what is the VAERS system. And it stands for Vaccine-Related Adverse Events Reporting System. And it's a wide open system. And a lot of people don't recognize, but the CDC actually adjusted the requirements for reporting when the COVID-19 vaccines came out, and they expanded those reporting requirements, basically mandating that healthcare professionals that are taking care of a patient and know of a severe adverse event, such as death or hospitalization, that has any association in terms of time with a vaccine must be reported to the VAERS system, even though the healthcare professional is absolutely convinced it had nothing to do with the vaccine. So the reporting is not based on causation, it's really based on time association. And that's important to recognize. And so if you look at the VAERS data right now, a little over 9,300 deaths have been reported in the VAERS data in association, quote, in association with the vaccines. And to really be able to process that and answer the question, is there an association between the vaccine and death, we have to look at and understand what is the underlying mortality without any type of vaccination. In other words, how many people die every day from everyday causes? And that number is really about 870 deaths per 100,000. And I have another slide that kind of lays it out. Obviously, that varies depending on the age of the person. Mm-hmm. But overall, a good average is about 870 per 100,000 population. And that's here in the United States. So if you take 3 months of that, you get about 420,000 people would be expected to have died. that got the vaccine. And that number, again, is 166 million people have been vaccinated here in the United States. Mm-hmm. So I'm throwing out a lot of numbers. But 166 million over 3 months, how many would you expect to die completely unrelated to whatever vaccine or whatever? And that's about 1,000 people every day mm-hmm. that just would die normally. Well, when you look at the fact that the VAERS data has now reported 8,000 deaths, the only surprise that I have is that it isn't higher than that, because that's been reported over several months. And in that period of time, we should have had hundreds of thousands of deaths that may have been just tangentially associated or just by chance associated with the time. So it's critical to understand that the deaths have not been shown to be associated with the COVID vaccine as we look at the studies. Now, having said that, there are a couple of things that have come up within the VAERS data that have been shown to be associated with the vaccine. The first one that most people are aware of is myocarditis. And this has been associated solely with the mRNA vaccine. Mm-hmm. It's typically in younger men, and it's at a very low risk. We're talking about something in the range of about 2 per 100,000. Okay? And that comes from Israeli data. And that's higher than what we would expect, so that's clearly a side effect, a concern with the vaccines. But if you look also at the important question, well, how many people that get COVID-19 develop myocarditis?
Sure.
The answer out of Israel is 11 per 100,000. So actually, it's about 2 to 3 times the number that we're seeing with the vaccination. So though there is a concern with the vaccine with that, it's a very low concern. Another risk factor that's come up has been the thrombosis with thrombocytopenia syndrome, which is TTS. That's been associated with the Johnson & Johnson vaccine as well as the AstraZeneca overseas. Again, that one is a very unusual complication. It's running about in the rate of about 1 every 300,000 vaccinations. That's hitting young women, typically under the age of 50. And to me, the answer for that is if a young woman is wanting to get vaccinated, instead of having the Johnson & Johnson or AstraZeneca, if you're overseas, is to get an mRNA vaccine, which has not shown any association with that TTS syndrome at all. There's also been a few reports of Guillain-Barré syndrome, which is a form of paralysis that's temporary. That's also very rare, about 2 per 100,000.
And we're used to seeing that with vaccines over the last many decades.
That's been associated with several vaccines. It's not a real surprise. And that also does occur with COVID-19 as well. So aside from these very rare but serious complications, we found overall that the vaccines are indeed very safe.
The other issue that comes up all the time, I would think one of the most common conversations that we have internally between ourselves and with the other physicians that we have on staff would be the issue of natural immunity. And it's been one that has caused, I think I've seen you scratching your head a few times in relationship to the lack of it being addressed, maybe by authoritative bodies like the CDC. The one study that I heard not too long ago coming out of Israel compared immunity measured in three different groups, and the group that had the highest immunity was those who had recovered from COVID-19 and had one, I think it was Moderna, one Moderna vaccine. So talk to us about natural immunity and what we now know in October 2021.
Yeah, I have been disappointed at the lack of research. There's some now coming out on natural immunity, but a lot of it is coming, like you said, from Israel and across the world, not here in the United States. And being 18 months into a pandemic, you would think that we would have a lot more information, but it is what it is. And so back to that Israeli study that you mentioned, there were three groups that they looked at. They looked at a group of people who had not had an infection and they got vaccinated. Mm-hmm. There was a group that had the infection and didn't get vaccinated, and then there was a group that had both. And they did show initially that the natural immunity was very strong, that those who did not have natural immunity but got vaccinated were 13 times more likely to get a reinfection, especially with Delta. So at first, people were saying, wow, this is great about natural immunity. Then they broke down the data and they looked at the date of the initial infection, and they found that with increasing time, there was waning immunity. And I think one of the best ways to really show that is another slide that I have. And this, again, is a study that looks at mRNA vaccinations as related to the natural infection. And it was from Strasbourg, Austria. And they looked at healthcare professionals. And they had gotten the infection early on. And on the slide on the left, you see, actually, this is measuring antibody activity in vitro to the Delta variant, the various variants, in fact. And on the left part of the slide are people that had the infection, never got the vaccination, and you can see the lower the number on the slide, the less immunity. So actually, they found that against the Beta variant and the Delta variant, there was no immunity 12 months after they got the infection. But on the right side is a group of people that got vaccinated with mRNA vaccines, and they had immunity 12 months after. So the other point I would make is not all infections are the same when they give natural immunity. In other words, somebody that has a positive PCR test but is essentially asymptomatic, mm-hmm. they're probably going to have a very different immune response than somebody who has severe disease
is
hospitalized. So what we're learning now is, first of all, that there is, yes, some protection from natural immunity, from a natural infection, but that probably wanes in time, especially against the Delta variant, so that it's probably better, especially for those at high risk, to think about getting vaccinated at a minimum with at least one mRNA vaccine, and if they're immunocompromised or whatever, to get a full vaccination.
Well, one of the areas when I watching national news or listening to a program on another podcast that's coming up quite frequently, because it's really the area of research and in the pandemic and vaccines specifically is in the pediatric population. Update us at what's happening right now. What are the recommendations and where do you think we're headed in terms of kids?
Well, as many who are listening to this podcast would probably know that May 10th, the FDA granted an EUA, emergency use authorization, to Pfizer to extend their vaccine to 12 and 15-year-olds. So prior to that, Pfizer had been approved with an EUA for 16 and up. Moderna was approved for ages 18 and up, and same with Johnson & Johnson. But Pfizer had gone down to 16 and 17-year-olds, so they had a little bit more data in the younger age. And then in May, again, they were granted that emergency use authorization. And then August, they actually got full approval from the FDA for that 16 and older age group. So I think that's good news. What they found is that the efficacy for the vaccine in that younger group, the data they submitted to the FDA, was really pretty much in line in terms of the efficacy for the adults. It was 95% or higher. The side effect profile was essentially the same, with most of the side effects being either a local reaction or systemic fever for a day or two, usually worse with the second injection. So we're hopeful, and so far 8.9 million adolescents now have gotten the Pfizer vaccine. So far, there hasn't been any other blip that's shown up with an issue other than the myocarditis, which continues to be a concern. So Moderna has put in their application with the FDA to get approval for the 12 to 17-year-old group. No idea when they will see and get a hearing. Pfizer, in addition, has put in their request for the 5-year-old to 11-year-old to get approval. And apparently, they have a hearing scheduled with the FDA later this month. So I know that both Pfizer, Moderna, and Johnson & Johnson are looking at vaccinations for as young as 6 months.
You wrote an article entitled Ethical Vaccines. We spent a lot of time 6 months ago on this podcast and for the video talking about the ethics. Clearly, the focal point of the discussion is on the use of the fetal kidney cell line that came from aborted fetuses from 40, 50, 60 years ago. You recently wrote another point blog on this very topic. We thought the issues were basically settled. There's still going to be a small percentage, it seems, who say that fetal cell line association means that we shouldn't be supporting these vaccines. Where do you stand right now on this issue, Jeff?
Well, I have to be honest that when I first heard about the association of abortion-derived fetal cell lines with these vaccines, my emotional gut reaction was negative. Well, I don't want any part of it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's it's disgusting to even think about. It's abhorrent to us that are pro-life. Early on, I made a decision, well, what do other ethicists say about it? And I began researching it. And as you've alluded to, the central core question is, are we complicit with the evil of the abortion when we take one of these vaccines? And it turns out that ethicists, Christian ethicists, both Protestant and Catholic, have thought a great deal about this and are used to addressing this whole question of complicity with evil. And we even in our position statement on immunization talk about this. And there are three criteria that need to be addressed in order to avoid complicity with evil. And that's what I really tried to expand on when I wrote the recent Point blog article. And just very briefly, the first one is we have to make sure that the original abortion was not done for the purpose of creating the vaccine or creating the cell line. If there was evidence that the abortion was done in order to create the cell line, we would be complicit with evil. That would end the discussion. But evidence is exactly the opposite. Not only is there not evidence that there was, there's evidence that the person didn't even know that this was going to be happening. The second thing is that when we take the vaccine, we have to make sure we're not incentivizing pharmaceutical companies and other researchers to go after and do other abortions to continue creating new future fetal cell lines. And of course, we don't want that. And that's why we've been very active in CMDA in advocating against it, writing letters to the pharmaceutical companies, letters to various government agencies saying, we don't like this. This is highly distasteful to us. And we know that it would be very beneficial if you were to create what I like to call an ethically pure vaccine. And I think all of us as Christians would then go that way. So that's the second requirement. The third is that there be an adequate amount of good that is derived from taking the vaccine, which we've already talked about in terms of the efficacy and preventing death.
Well, finally, I wanted to ask you to address what probably is the most sensitive arena of this pandemic, which has been the divisiveness that's come from the various issues, whether it's ethics, vaccine efficacy, vaccine mandates, just all sorts of topics. And this year I've been really diving deep into Paul's letters to the Corinthian church. And in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, he says, I appeal to you, brothers, that there should be no, in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, that there should be no divisions among you, but that you should be perfectly, he says, united in mind and thought. And yet, wow, now they were saying, I follow Paul, I follow Apollos, I follow Cephas, I follow Christ. So it wasn't a pandemic and it wasn't management of SARS-CoV-2 virus and vaccines. But you have shared with me that you came across an excellent book. I believe it's called The Righteous Mind. And that has opened some windows of understanding for you.
Yeah, like you, Mike, I was puzzled by the degree of division that's not only happening within our members at CMDA and the lack of ability to somehow look at the same data and to come up with completely different conclusions has been a huge puzzle for me. And it's also true in the church. And so I'd heard about this book. I don't remember who had recommended it, but they had said that this person had done the best job in terms of explaining exactly why it happens. And you're right, it's called The Righteous Mind by Jonathan Haidt, H-A-I-D-T. And I want to give our listeners a little warning. Jonathan Haidt is not a Christian. In fact, he's an atheist. He's highly liberal. He probably does not agree with any of our
amazing statements. He would use the word righteous.
Yeah, yeah. So you might say, well, why would we even listen to him? Well, he has made a life study of why and how people make moral decisions. He's a moral psychologist. And his data is amazing, and it really has opened up a couple of things. And the way that Haidt looks at this whole issue as to how we make a moral decision, he uses the illustration of an elephant and a rider. And the elephant itself is our intuition. The rider is the rational portion of our brain. And I think most of us start out with the premise that, you know, I think the rational brain kind of guides our elephant into making the decisions. And what Haidt found, it was exactly the opposite. It is the elephant. Whichever way the elephant is leaning, in other words, wherever our intuition is leading, that will take us in a direction. And what happens is our rational thinking then finds facts to back up the position that the elephant is going to. And I think you have some personal experience with that.
Yeah, as soon as you were sharing with me about this book and this idea, it took me back to my first few years in practice. I trained in general surgery, and in my first few years of practice, did quite a bit of breast surgery for breast cancer, and learned how to do mastectomies, breast conservation surgery, but also axillary node dissection. And then I moved to Kenya and did some breast surgery there, and I heard about this new thing called sentinel lymph node biopsies, with identifying one or two lymph nodes and sampling those and letting those guide the future therapy. And my reaction is, how can this possibly work? And by the way, you do this because it's less morbid and there's less arm edema. I'm thinking, I never had any of my patients have bad arm edema, and This just can't be right, because there's going to be too many cases of advanced breast cancer that are going to be missed. That was my intuition. And so we started having in the meetings, the gatherings that we would have that CMDA sponsored there in Nairobi, we'd have speakers come and start talking to us about these sentinel lymph node biopsies. And I would be the first person to raise my hand in the back of the room. And I just said, you know, this data can't, you know, it's not been long enough, and it's this can't possibly be good enough. And I would push back against my intuition that this must be the wrong thing. It was years later, honestly, Jeff, 5 or 6 years later, when I finally came back to the States and Michigan and saw that everybody around me was doing this procedure, much more literature had come out, and it was clear that I was on the, I don't know, the wrong side of history, but I was definitely behind the curve in terms of adopting this, because I just couldn't figure out how it could possibly be right. And I wish that I had done a better job of paying attention to the data early on and let that be my guide instead of my early impression of how this couldn't possibly work.
Well, I think your point is well taken in that it affects all of us. I mean, the danger we would have is to say, okay, we don't have to worry about our elephant. We've got our rational mind in control, and that's another blind side. And so I think the lesson for all of us is, just like when I was first hit with the fact that these vaccines were going to be developed with abortion-derived fetal cell lines, and I was just repulsed by that, is to recognize that this is happening in all of us, especially with important decisions. And I think that's important, because if we recognize it's happening, then we have a potential where we can take a step back and say, okay, I really don't like the idea of going this way in my moral decision. Mm. But just like you said, if we're willing to look simply at the facts, at the best evidence, we might be able to pull that elephant back in a different direction. But if we never take that step of stepping back, then we get caught going further and further down the road with our elephant, trying to justify where our elephant is. All the time we're missing the fact that the best medical evidence, at least right now that I can see, and I don't think that's an elephant decision, the best medical evidence right now is clearly overwhelming that these vaccines are saving lives, saving hospitalizations, and definitely need to be utilized.
Well, we've both been asked questions by our members, physicians who've been practicing for a long time, questions that have left us scratching our heads and wondering where those questions from. And I don't really need to emphasize or remind our listeners or our viewers that there's a whole lot of pressure riding upon us as caregivers, because if anything, the data shows us that where patients want to get that information for the most part is from their trusted primary caregivers. Yes. That they've been with. And I was with one of our own staff out in the field not too long ago, and I asked him the question, you know, just after I had a chance to get to talk to him a bit and understand that he wouldn't be offended by my question. And I said, hey, John, did you get vaccinated? And he said, my physician told me that I've already had COVID, proven COVID by testing, and I don't need to be vaccinated. He strongly recommended I not be vaccinated. And so, hey, that's the person I'm listening to. And I hope that won't bother you, Dr. Chubb, that I didn't get vaccinated. So, no, I fully understand. I mean, and when I go to my physician, that's going to have a great deal of influence upon me. And so we do have an ethics statement that our ethics committee came up with last year at the beginning of the pandemic called the duty to care. The duty to care includes the duty to have an informed conscience and to be completely informed. And so, once again, could you just maybe address, how can we keep the elephant best at bay?
I think the first step is to recognize that we're being influenced by the elephant, and then to really, I mean, I went through my training as an OBGYN, and I remember in residency, when I would talk about a particular decision, the senior resident would always say, "Where's the study? Where's the study?" I don't hear that much today. And I think we can kind of challenge ourselves. What is the factual study that I can use that can back that up? And of course, information is coming out all the time. So I think it really is incumbent on all of us that are still involved in clinical care to be staying up to date. What is the evidence for boosters with Pfizer, which I think there's pretty good evidence. There's not as much evidence for those that have taken the Moderna vaccine, like myself. And there's a difference between the two vaccines. Pfizer used 30 micrograms of mRNA. Moderna used 100 micrograms of mRNA. And also, Pfizer was 3 weeks apart. Moderna was 4 weeks apart. A lot of people will say, well, there's only 1 week difference. If you talk to immunologists, then 1 week is enough to continually allow the immune system to get ready to boost and get a higher boost in that 1 week waiting period, that extra waiting period. So I think it's incumbent on all of us as healthcare professionals to stay current, make sure we're looking at data, and that's good data. Data hopefully from prospective, randomized studies as much as possible, but lots of numbers, not just 20, 30, 40, whatever, but good numbers and good quality studies.
Jeff, what have you used? What would you say have been your main sources of that data that you're talking about?
I really like the New England Journal of Medicine's. They have fortunately opened up access to all their articles to free to the public. Lancet has got a lot of good studies. I get a weekly or twice a week kind of bulletin from Johns Hopkins and their COVID-19 center, which is filled with all kinds of information. So between those three things, it's tended to keep me fairly busy.
You've also told me about a weekly video that you get, that a virology?
There is a great podcast that I became aware of called TWIV. It's known as This Week in Virology.
Okay.
I began listening to it about 2 or 3 weeks ago. It comes out several times.
One of our board members, I think, told you about it.
Yes, Dr. Amy Gibler told me about it. And it's amazing. It's really in-depth. If you really are interested in learning in-depth on some of the studies, the basic science and virology, it's got a couple of those each week. But they typically, at the week's end, have a clinician that practices in New York that kind of summarizes the data that's come out that particular week, and it's been excellent.
Thank you. Thank you for joining us this week on CMDA Matters for this discussion. I do want to challenge our listeners to pray for your CMDA in this process. Pray for Dr. Barrows. We really do want to be full of integrity and to try to keep our own elephants at bay and to pay attention to the data as it stands and to try as much as we can to keep politics and to keep this a public health issue. I have a feeling we'll be back in future editions of CMDA Matters talking about some aspect of the COVID pandemic. But I do want to encourage you to pray for us as we pray for all of you, our members, moving forward. Thank you for your service on the front lines for COVID patients. And God willing, we'll see you next week. Well, at the very least, I hope that our discussion today, now nearly 2 years into this pandemic, has challenged you in one way or another, maybe to reflect on the different views that you hold, the perspectives that Jeff talked about, and that whole concept of the elephant in the room, the undeniable bias that we bring into every conversation when we talk about controversial issues like vaccines or proposed treatments for COVID or masks or whatever the hot conversation that you find yourself in related to this pandemic. At CMDA and CMDA Matters, we always want to be open to you, whether you're our listeners or our members, when you ask good and hard questions, especially when those questions arise from solid, well-conducted clinical trials, or even more critical, questions that are related to God's inspired and revealed truth in His Word. Well, we're just a few weeks away from the upcoming Global Missions Health Conference that'll be held November 11th through 13th in Louisville, Kentucky.
And if you put it off, there's still time to register. I'd love to see you at the conference, so be sure to visit our CMDA booths in the main exhibit hall when you come. You can learn more about the various service opportunities that we offer through CMDA's mission team outreaches. Whether you've ever attended or not, you are highly welcome. So just visit medicalmissions.com now for more information and to register today. We're only 2 weeks away from CMDA's Emerging Leaders in Dentistry Regional Conference that's coming October 29th and 30th. It'll be held in Augusta, Georgia. The Emerging Leaders Conference is designed specifically to empower Christian dental students across the country with education, as well as encouragement and equipping, in order that students in their future careers might glorify God. You can click our link in the show notes today or visit cmda.org/events to learn more as well as to register. I do want to invite you back next week to listen in on a three-way conversation between our Director for Leadership and Church Relations, Reverend Bert Jones, as well as an orthopedic surgeon from the great state of Oregon named Brick Lance. Dr. Lance, I think he's an incredible example of what God can do in and through a busy practicing physician who witnesses firsthand a downward spiral in the morality of his own community, as well as some local churches there in Oregon, and then who, instead of just shaking his head and walking away frustrated like many of us would do, he decided to do something about it. And that something is an 8-week question and answer based curriculum that Brick developed with the help as well as the encouragement of CMDA's CEO Emeritus, Dr. David Stevens, as well as the expertise of more than 40 CMDA bioethicists across the country. Dr. Lance and Pastor Bert want you to experience our Bridging the Gap curriculum in your own church soon. So please come back next week and hear what it is all about. I want to thank you for listening today to this special edition of CMDA Matters and my conversation with our Senior Vice President for Bioethics and Public Policy, Dr. Jeff Barrows, on the controversies that have surrounded the COVID-19 pandemic. I know that discovering truth and demonstrating compassion matter to each one of our CMDA members and you, our listeners, and our many champions. And so I pray that God will help us demonstrate to a lost and despairing world that it matters greatly to CMDA and CMDA matters. God willing, I want to see you next week.
This podcast has been a production of the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. The opinions expressed by guests on this podcast are not necessarily endorsed by the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. CMDA is a nonpartisan organization that does not endorse political parties or candidates for public office. The views expressed on this podcast reflect judgments regarding principles and values held by CMDA and its members and are not intended to imply endorsement of any political party or candidate.